This is the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure, number 157B, page 666. And we've just been talking about the law of disintegration and death, and seeing how it's necessary not just to look at a small extracted section of a paragraph, but to look at the entire paragraph. So the law of vibration is certainly Neptune, and sacrifice and death is related to is Vulcan, rather. The law of vibration is related to Vulcan, and sacrifice and death is related to Neptune. The first law and the seventh law, the creative form and the destroyer or dissolver by gradual method of form. And DK goes on to describe a synthesis in form, which is Vulcanian, and a synthesis in life, which is formless and is related to Neptune. No man begins to coordinate the Buddhic vehicle until he comes under the influence of Neptune, and when this happens, his personality horoscope will show this influence as dominant. Now sometimes, how dominant, how? Neptune on angles, conjunct sun, moon, or ascendant, or a ruling planet, or Cancer, or Pisces, prominent, or Virgo, and the moon in Virgo. There are various ways of bringing in the Neptunian vibration. Now, this coordination of the Buddhic vehicle, we can say that in a way it begins before the third initiation, but it is particularly found after the third initiation. Let's see if I can look at that this a little more closely. I have references to it. I'm going to say coordinate Buddhic. And there are maybe three references. We'll see. The Buddhic vehicle only begins to coordinate as the lower impulses fade out. I've come to think that this is happening mostly after the third initiation, when the emphasis shifts from mentality to Buddhi. Okay, and this is the occult truism that energy follows thought in this line too. With the teaching of the body of the Christ principle, the Buddhic vehicle only begins to coordinate as the lower impulses fade out. Now, what I will also do is look here and let's just see here if we can find this Buddhic vehicle. Seventh subplane of the Buddhic vehicle, coordinating the Buddhic vehicle, coordinating the Buddhic vehicle and incorporating matter of the seventh subplane. Here it is. He begins rapidly, and this is after the third degree. He begins rapidly to coordinate the Buddhic vehicle, and in its coordination he develops the power of synthesis, at first in small measure and gradually in fuller detail. This is following the third degree. Okay. After the third initiation, the corresponding stimulation takes place in the permanent atoms of the triad, leading to a coordination of the Buddhic vehicle and the transference of the lower polarization into the higher. After the third initiation, the corresponding situation takes place, etc. It's also found in Cosmic Fire on page 208. So I think the shift in emphasis occurs following the third initiation, which brings one into the sublime light under Venus. And then since Neptune is the higher octave of Venus, Venus, which rules higher mind and illumination, gives way to Neptune, which rules the Buddhic plane. So Neptune-Venus, you know, it's not just romantic love in the horoscope or appreciation for music and the arts. from an esoteric point of view, it's the possibility of bringing both the buddhi and the manas together, the higher manas, and to begin focusing upon the intuition rather than the light of the higher mind as found on the second subplane of the higher mental plane, over which Venus, I think, will preside. Okay. So no man begins to coordinate the Buddhic vehicle until he comes under the influence of Neptune. Now, there is a sense in which some of this can begin to work after the second degree, because we have tranquilized the astral body to the extent that it can become a quite a pure reflector of the intuition. But the real focus of the man following the third degree really is buddhi and the coordination of the buddhic vehicle. What's interesting here is to show that while we may have these vehicles in somewhat inchoate form, they do not become coordinated until later in the process of evolution. So this goes for the higher mental vehicle and for the atmic vehicle. And I suppose the coordination of the atmic vehicle would, by analogy, follow the fourth initiation, because that's where the attention will go on the way to mastership. The Neptunian scheme governs one of the three paths of return and gathers to itself eventually all those egos who attain primarily through handling six-ray energy. So it is one of the synthesizing schemes, and that peculiar group of egos, such as what DK calls the Occidental mystic, would go to Neptune. And I suppose, I think Neptune will not be the one of the paths of return. Well, this is, are we dealing with the absorption of the planet itself, or are we dealing with the possibility of transference of human units to different planets? That does happen as well. The, let's put it like this here, the transference of human units to different planets on the way of higher evolution does occur. And I think these people seem to be those with the six-ray soul or the six-ray monad. And there are monads of the six-ray, we do know. And when we study the stanzas of the Blessed Ones, the one who caught the vision of the way and followed the way without discretion and so forth, we are talking of a sixth subray of the major three monadic rays. So let's take a look here on page 899 of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. And three paths, let's see what we mean by the paths of return. Because we would have to leave our planet to go to this place, the Neptunian place. The planet has also a vital relation, let's see. The major scheme over which Neptune presides forms a systemic triangle of great interest for esoteric astrologers with the sixth scheme and one other. Mars is oftentimes called the sixth scheme, maybe Venus. This is symbolized in the three-pronged trident which the god Neptune is always portrayed as holding, prongs being literally the symbolic triangles connected with each other by the three lines of force. So this is connecting a number of triangles, it looks like. The planet has also a vital relation to the sixth logoic principle, the Buddhi, and therefore the sixth principle in man. See, this is the elaboration which makes it clearer. No man begins to coordinate the Buddhic vehicle until he comes under the Neptunian influence in some life or another. And when this is the case, his personality horoscope will show this. Neptune influence dominating somewhere. The Neptunian scheme governs one of the three paths of return. And there seem to be, I think, more than three paths of return, but maybe what we're talking about is the synthesizing schemes as being the three paths of return, and gathers to itself eventually all those egos, higher E and maybe triad monads, who attain primarily through the manipulation of the sixth type of energy usually called devotion. It is Neptunian influence likewise which presides over and makes possible the second initiation, wherein the initiate produces results in the astral body, and wherein his astral centers are the object of the Hierophant's attention. This particular type of energy flows through three centers. Okay, the planet Neptune, and this is so interesting, the planet Neptune, along with the planetary logos of the sixth ray, controls the astral centers in man, and that planetary logos of the sixth ray is going to be Venus. So normally you would think that Neptune is the planetary logos of the sixth ray, but instead it's really a second ray monadic planetary logos. This statement involves much esoteric macrocosmic significance. When it is remembered that all centers, human and divine, are composed of deva essence, the connection between this influence and the devas and their reflex effect upon man will become immediately apparent. So this is an important page concerning Neptune. And we're talking about the Raja Deva Lord, Varuna, connected here with the astral body, or with the astral flame. Within our the expression of our planetary logos. So the planet Neptune therefore has a profound effect and close connection via the law of correspondences with the sixth or astral plane, etc., and with the sixth ray. All right, well that gives us maybe enough background. But when we talk about three paths of return, there are many more. There are more paths of return. But in the synthesizing which occurs within our solar system, Neptune is one of three synthesizing planets, thus offering one path of return. Now, the question is, if we are a monad of the sixth ray, or a soul of the sixth ray, let's just say, we may not remain with the earth, which may disappear before the end of the Mahamanvantara. So if we are strongly affected by the sixth ray, our gravitation may be towards Neptune, from which it is possible that many came. Because remember about the Earth, that the Earth is not one of the sacred planets, and although Venus lasts throughout the Mahamanvantara, Earth does not. Would this mean that Earth disappears before the end of the Mahamanvantara, or that it did not appear at first in the beginning of the Mahamanvantara. But let's take a look at that statement. Venus, Mahamanvantara 4. Okay. In connection with the two planets, it must be remembered that Venus is the sacred planet, Earth is not. This means that certain of the planets are to the Logos what the permanent atoms are to man. They embody principles. Certain planets afford only a temporary home to these principles. Others persist throughout the Mahamanvantara, and of this, Venus is one. So we are going to expect, so it seems, that our planet does not last throughout the Mahamanvantara, and that we will eventually find our way to some other planet. Okay, TCF 298 and 299. And what will that planet be? Well, it will be probably according to our nature. And if we have a six-ray soul, or even more so, perhaps a six-ray monad, we will find our way perhaps to Neptune. Venus is also a possibility. It is the lower octave. But Venus eventually synthesizes itself into Neptune. So let's say that, whoop, that's not right. We'll put it like this, that since Venus is synthesized by Neptune, Venus with its sixth ray monad, even if we find our way to Venus, we will eventually find our way to Neptune, as Venus is absorbed. Of course, you know, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. We have enough tasks to handle immediately. But we can think about our destination and perhaps come into significant rapport with certain planetary sources, because they do represent our destiny. Some of us may have the Mercury-Uranus connection. Others may have the Venus-Neptune connection. But it all ends up in one place, really. Imagining, let us say, that in this second-ray solar system, Uranus may be, its principles may be absorbed into Neptune, and Neptune into the Sun. It all ends up in the Sun, or within the solar logos. And as I've said, a question remains: if we go elsewhere for training, do we come back to be reabsorbed into our own solar logos? What is the separability of a monad, which apparently belongs to the solar logos, from that solar logos? All right, well, that was quite an exploration. Sometimes you have to ponder about these things before the understanding comes. Neptune presides over and makes possible the second initiation, along with what planets? Venus and Jupiter, who apparently contend. Jupiter, I think, may be in its somewhat lower function, but at least it expands the astral body. Venus refines it, and Neptune renders it recipient of transcendental love, or of transcendent love, or even simply of the love of the soul. He does say an interesting thing about Venus and Jupiter. Venus, Jupiter, second, contend. That's the word. So he's talking about the second initiation here. The first initiation, he has to contend with the influences of Pluto and Vulcan, with which humanity is contending right now. Crystallizing, destroying, dragging to the surface all the unpleasant shameful things. The training for the second initiation brings him under the Neptunian influences with Venus and Jupiter contending for control. Why would they? They both are benefic planets, we're told, and they both have lots of second ray connected with them. And do they finally reach a kind of harmony? He did leave out Neptune here, and of course, the real beginning, I think, of the intuitive life is greatly enhanced and promoted after the second initiation, which is ruled in part by Neptune. Neptune rules the Buddhic plane. Neptune has a touch with the monadic plane. Neptune connects with the cosmic astral plane. That whole line of straight knowledge is stimulated. And the subtlety of feelings is greatly increased. Via Neptune, the subtlety of feelings is enhanced. Let's just say enhancement of sensitivity. So we could have Sirius, Leo, Neptune, sensitivity. And the heart of the sun affects the astral body. And Neptune stores the solar flames. Neptune is the repository of the solar flames. So the quality of our emotional life is quite changed and more solarized. A warmth enters, a spiritual warmth, let's call it, a spiritual warmth enters it. So Neptune presides and makes possible the second initiation and is one of the major synthesizing planets, as we have much discussed. Is an absorbing or abstracting planet? Yes, absorbing Venus particularly, but perhaps having made their way to Venus are those who have, maybe a blend. The higher principles of Venus are very much on the second ray line, the soul more on the fifth ray line, love and light. If one has gravitated to Venus in preparation for, let's put it like this. One gravitates to Venus on the way of higher evolution for training before going to Sirius. So one can return and be absorbed into Venus, which is absorbed into Neptune. Neptune is connected with the perfecting process. Well, perfection, interesting. Perfection is associated with the number 4. Completion and perfection are sometimes synonymous. Jupiter, looking like a 4, is the planet of completion. On the atmic plane, we have perfection. The city, or the psychic power, called perfection. Neptune rules, in part, the fourth plane, the Buddhic plane. So Neptune is even a greater refiner than Venus, which contributes, of course, to the perfecting process. A perfection is a condition of completeness and harmony. Of completeness and harmony. Okay. there's not too much we can say about it. It is a city which pertains to the masters and which immediately precedes what is called all knowledge. So it's a very high state, and it shows there is therefore a connection between Neptune and the atmic plane, or at least one faculty to be developed on the atmic plane. We have to be cleansed by the water. We have to be harmonized. We have to be able to flow into and pervade. You know what? These are all part of the perfecting process. Perfecting, cleansing, harmonizing, pervading, presence. I might even say omnipresence, no barriers. All of these Neptune contributes to. And of course, the sensitizing, without which there can be no harmonization. So it seems fairly clear, Neptune does contribute to the perfecting process. Maybe all planets do, but there's some refined sense of beauty in Neptune, a refined sense of transcendent beauty in connection or through Neptune. So sometimes, as Robert Browning did, he looked at humanity and he saw half-formed creatures around, far from beauty, far from harmony, far from completeness. There's so much of the Buddhic plane which rounds things out. That's the way Jupiter contributes to it. It brings in completeness, but the completeness has to be rational. There's Mercury, and it has to be harmonized and coalesce so that a mystical transcendental radiation comes forth from all that has been gathered and harmonized and coalesced. And that's the province of Neptune. Neptune is the repository of the solar flames. Well, it can mean many things, I suppose, but when we think of the solar flames, we also think of the solar angels and their relation to both Venus and Neptune. What specifically does this mean? 1154, cosmic fire. I suppose if we just go to 1154, we're going to find it. Let's see. Here it is. The blazing forth spoken of in the occult books and in the secret doctrine is an etheric matter. It is this etheric fiery energy which brings to a consummation and so destroys the remaining three major schemes. That we're talking about the period of final absorption here of the three synthesizing planets. In this we have a correspondence to the burning of the causal body at the fourth initiation through the merging of the three fires. The form then destroys the connection, the atomic triangle. It is only a correspondence and the details must not be pushed too far. The Saturn scheme is esoterically regarded as having absorbed the frictional fires of systemic space. Neptune is looked to as the repository of the solar flames, and Uranus as the home of fire electric. I begin to see this in a new context. So this is 1154. and should be brought in with TCF 1154. And it's a question of which synthesizing planet absorbs what. Which synthesizing planet absorbs what type of energy? So the different, the three fires I now see, are differently absorbed. And all that is most conditioned by solar fire is absorbed by Neptune. And this probably has to do with can it be related to the three types of monadic rays. But then these planets also begin absorbing each other, and Saturn, I would say, you know, being absorbed into Uranus, and at my present level of hypothesis, Uranus absorbed into Neptune, the final repository for everything in this second ray solar system. Now that's something that only DK or some master would be able to confirm or deny. We don't seem to have the evidence yet. But it seems to me that a final Uranus being absorbed into the Sun in the next solar system is likely. Whereas in this solar system, will Neptune be with us again? in this solar system, Neptune would seem to be final, but those who are strongly conditioned along the 246 line, who have been to Sirius, who have perhaps pursued an angelic path, who, if they have been on the ray path, have been working with rays 2, 4, and 6, when the time for absorption comes, if they are in our solar system, I mean, that has to do with the separability of a monadic unit from its original sun, something to be discussed and thought about, then they would be such ray-conditioned units would be absorbed into planets that have a second-ray monad. And such planets would be Venus and Neptune. So if there are still solar angels in our solar system at that time, and who's to say that will not be, they are hearts of fiery love. They are very connected with Venus in a sense, but ultimately solar angels would be absorbed into Neptune. And Uranus, I suppose, with its first ray monad being the home of electric fire, would absorb the seeds of the next solar system. Somewhere it talked about that, about the planet that contained the seeds for the next solar system. Uranus would absorb the seeds of the next solar system. The first rayness of Uranus is sometimes present or seen now. It can create extremely disruptive circumstances. And synthesizing planets do manifest their monadic ray to a degree, whereas non-sacreds do not. They are occultly ineffective. So, but the solar ray is the major thing to manifest in this particular solar system, and the non-sacred planets are trying to bring their expression up to that requirement. In the next solar system, these logoi will manifest strongly their monadic ray. And I suppose that the various chakras in our system, rather than having such a strong petal influence, will have a very strong jewel in the lotus influence. The planet Pluto, well, we're going through a collection of the planets here. They are interesting from the secret doctrine perspective. I don't think we're going to find too much in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire as it was written before Pluto was discovered, unless there is a hint. Pluto is the deity with the attributes of the serpent. So we have, what can we say, Kundalini, serpent. He is a healer, and I would say through ejection, a giver of health. That is not so much understood in contemporary astrology. Spiritual and physical, and of enlightenment, clearing away impediments. Okay. That's very strange. Clearing the impediments so that the light can flow in. Pointing also to the illuminative potential of its higher rays. It's not so much that the first ray produces illumination, or even the sixth, but it seems that the third or the fifth ray somehow are connected with Pluto. There's a strong mental emphasis both in Pluto and in Mars. This is very interesting. Pluto is the deity with the attributes of the serpent. So Kundalini and also transformatively shedding its skin. He is a healer. So sometimes when you see Pluto and Chiron together, you know, great pain can be indicated, but also the possibility of healing great pain. And if Uranus is there as well, it's through alternative means, Pluto, Chiron, Uranus, in some relationship with each other. A giver of health, power, vitality. It's also negatively vampirism and is draining away one's vitality, as in a sort of a Pluto-Neptune conjunction. But then on the other hand, the breaking up of glamour under Pluto-Neptune is quite strong. I think one of the things I should do is maybe discuss aspects from an esoteric point of view. I've written so many things that have never been published. They sit on the computer, and I'd like to get them out. It just strikes me that I should do that and maybe make a note, right, on aspects, or at this point, it'll be speaking, if you don't mind. Or if you do mind, nevertheless, I think now it has to be speaking. So, the attributes of the serpent, he is a healer, giver of health, spiritual and physical, and of enlightenment. And if you think about his connection with the Kundalini, sort of clearing the paths for the maximal activation of all the different organs, etheric organs, and thus creating the greatest flow and the greatest health. Well, you know, clearing the path to the flow which creates health for the flow which creates full and vibrant health of the initiate. So following, you know, the third initiation, or following the fourth, or the fifth, there's going to be ongoing health. The health of the mechanism is not going to be the issue, unless some sacrifice is deliberately undertaken. Even Master R, who seems to have mastered the condition of physical immortality has to obey the rules and be cautious about what he will ingest. And the old saying about him is he never ate in public when he was the Comte de Saint-Germain. He was always in private, perhaps for that very reason, the preservation of the rules of immortality. Under the legend, Orpheus seeks in the kingdom of Pluto his lost soul, Eurydice. Krishna rescues from Pluto his six principles, being the seventh himself. Is he Atma or is he life itself? Sometimes the seventh principle is referred to as the Atman or the Brahman, life itself. He is the perfect initiate, the whole of his six principles merging into the seventh, and that is Krishna, that is Christ, the perfect initiate. But Pluto also represents the underworld. We are living in it now. So our higher principles are subject to the oppression of the, what do you call it, kind of a congestion of this lower world. Pluto is making an esoteric approach, we are told, to our planet now. Is that via a monadic ray? When the word esoteric is used, when everything is esoteric and the word esoteric is used, sometimes it's pointing in the direction of the monad. So our soul is lost in the realm of Pluto. It's not necessarily after death. In many ways, we are living in the realm of death right now. Realm of death. And our consciousness, our soul, our Eurydice, well, I'm afraid I only know the sort of Eurydice, Italian of it. Was it Orpheus and Eurydice? Well, anyway, there's an old song by Christoph Willibald Gluck. What shall I do without my Eurydice? Che farò senza ma Eurydice? Che farò? What will I do? Anyway, the man has lost his soul. And Eurydice is the symbol of the soul. And he goes seeking in the underworld for it. It's not just in the lower depths of the unconscious. It's also right here in our sensory world. Not only in the depths of the unconscious, which Pluto rules, but here in the lower worlds of form. It might even be easier to find one's soul in the realm of Hades or on the astral plane than it is here, so oppressed by the crystallizing effects of Vulcan and Saturn and Capricorn, where the awareness of consciousness as consciousness is stifled or crushed out. Let's say here, the consciousness or soul is more crushed out here than even upon the astral plane. It depends on what part of the astral plane, I suppose. So we do not have Plutonic references here in Cosmic Fire yet. We have, because, as I said, I don't think the masters are allowed to reveal that which is imminently to be discovered by man himself, as Pluto was discovered just 5 years after Treatise on Cosmic Fire was written. It had been, we learned, photographed in 1915, before Cosmic Fire was written, but in 1930, it was maybe re-photographed and detected as a planet, a very exciting thing for astronomers, one more thing coming to light. There are so many important contributing sources of energy which have not come to light. Well, how much can we handle? You know, we think maybe we could handle the whole thing, but we can't. I remember a person thinking the Great Invocation was a very bad thing because it talked about sealing the door where evil dwells, and maybe this person had been educated in psychology and said, oh, you never should shut a door on what is bad because then you can't handle it. But, of course, there is the ignorance there that humanity can't really handle the Black Lodge yet, or cosmic evil. And so it has to be driven back so a space can be cleared for the attention of humanity, the cleansing attention of humanity, without the interference of the Black Lodge, and that space would be our etheric physical planes. So get evil out of the way, seal the door, handle it later when there's a concerted Vulcanian attack on Glamour, using also the power of Venus and the power of Mercury. But the steadfast standing in will, the will to deglamorize, will come later, and illusion will be the last. The threefold cleansing of the Augean stables, which should be taking place in some measure during the age of Aquarius. With the planet Saturn, a very important one, is the father of the gods and has been transformed from eternal duration into the limited period. Well, Uranus now is considered the father. And Uranus connects with eternal duration and also with simultaneity. And is there much difference? We can look at Uranus as the destroyer of sequence and Saturn as the preserver of sequence. So finally, that Uranus-Saturn conjunction would be useful for the overcoming of time, if one can manage that. Jehovah, a lunar deity, really, we're told in the Secret Doctrine, was identified with Saturn and Vulcan. And hammer and the... how do you spell this? Sickle? Of Soviet communism demonstrates the presence of these two planets. Saturn, the sickle, related to Leo, which has a sickle in it, and Vulcan, the hammer. Hence the connection of Taurus and Leo through these two. So Jehovah is definitely working in form. Jehovah is generally has a very wrathful side. Of course, there are these wrathful deities. They are usually wrathful to preserve values. The question is this the case with Jehovah? Sometimes when we're told that Jehovah became jealous or he's a jealous God, what can that be but a projection of the limited human psyche? I'll put that down. Jehovah as a jealous God can only be the projection of a limited human psyche. So Jehovah is working in the realm of matter and I think has very material concerns. Saturn works in the realm of matter. This also might have something to do with the soul of Judea on the first ray, since both of these planets are strong conduits of the first ray. Vulcan in its soul and Saturn in its personality, and generally DK tells it's a strong expression of the first ray. So this is, in general, you can see not any nice second ray deity, and also a very limited deity, much concerned with form rather than soul. But anyway, Saturn and Vulcan, they have a very strong connection in the so-called men of will, as DK refers to them. You know, people who are disciples of Shambhala, think about that. Both of these planets are Shambhalic planets, right? Both are Shambhalic planets. Vulcan, through Taurus, and the Waysak festival, the time of greatest Shambhala contact, Saturn through connection with Leo. It goes Great Bear, Leo, Saturn, Shambhala, the law, the Ancient of Days. The factor of imposition is Vulcania, and the first ray works through imposition. Saturn is also an imposing, regimenting, structuring, holding planet. A fixation with Saturn, fixity. Imposition and fixity, both emanating from Shambhala. In time, the planet Saturn became reviled by those who worshipped other gods. That's interesting. I don't know what the context is, but I would say then the law suffered, I would suppose. We're fortunate in Aquarius that Saturn will be so strong in the first decanate, and it is also one of the conventional rulers of Aquarius, because we will be more subject to the law. Saturn, shall we say, brings opportunity, through law, because at least we don't deviate and take paths which slow our progress. If we stick to the law and are within due bounds, we will be able to conform to the plan. Saturn and the plan go together. If we are outside those boundaries, then our course of development may be retarded, led off the track, and a time delay, also Saturn, may result. What period was this from, when Saturn became reviled by those who worshipped other gods? It would be interesting then to see the context. Saturn was connected with Lemuria, and I believe I said so, you know. Saturn with Lemuria, perhaps Mars and Neptune with Atlantis, Venus and Mercury, but certainly Mercury with the Aryan race, and Venus with Neptune, I think, with the sixth root race. Also some strong Jupiter there. And some of the higher planets connected with the earlier root races, which were pre-human. So we have all the physical limitations and trials which Saturn presents. And it was the a man lived a very concrete life dealing with the physical plane which Saturn rules, and maybe being initiated through access to Uranus in its rulership over the etheric level, etheric plane. So, Saturn, we have seen, page 301, connected with the base of the spine, the anchoring. Let's say, how can we look at it, that the human soul was anchored via Saturn. And its freedom was curtailed by materiality. Now, I think the Atlanteans maybe didn't have so much Saturn. They did not restrain themselves. Mars wants what it wants when it wants it. There's Saturn saying no, restraint. Neptune has wishes, and Saturn says be realistic. Jupiter wants too much, and Saturn says keep your desires within due bounds. Saturn demands conformity to the higher patterns when it's being well used. That we call the plan, and to a degree even the purpose. Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn, well, we've done this before. The vehicles of the three super principles. We have discussed this one at length. But what is interesting, we are not yet to the point of solar systemic development when the three synthesizing planets can be the vehicles for the three major principles. We have a long way to go. We're really only halfway through our solar evolution. And from the chronology of the Brahmins, the solar system lasts a very long time. Trillions of years, a number which would be laughable to most scientists today, because they do consider even our whole universe is only 15 billion. So, you know, this is the funny part. Let's just say we have, I don't know how I can do this, 300, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 300 trillion divided by 15, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, equals, we have, well, if my calculation is correct, we have a solar system that is lasting about 20,000 times longer than the universe. So one sees the absurdity of that. Our solar system, or perhaps the incarnation of our solar logos and his retraction to his causal body, is said to last some 311 trillion years. Let me try it again, just for fun. 311, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, divided by 15, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, equals, well, pretty much almost 21,000 times longer than the entire universe. So how can the part last longer than the whole of which it is a part? We run into that problem also with the Pleiades. If they are they are the head or the center of the entire local cosmos system, our local one about whom naught may be said, and what if those fast-burning stars disappear before the rest of their system? But then again, you see, the system doesn't have to be directed by that which is obvious. The lives still exist, and even should their physical vehicles in some way burn out, they can create Maya Varupas because they are solar logoi of that stature. So new stars could appear, or they could control the whole from the inner planes. just because the physical application appears. I'm reminded a bit of Star Wars, you know. I'm not such a fan, but I liked it. And Obi-Wan Kenobi, who was the teacher of Luke Skywalker, sacrificed his life for a number of reasons. I'm assumed to protect Luke, but also because he could be more effective on the inner planes in the continuing war. So just, Master Moria says, you know, an enemy on the outer plane is less dangerous than an enemy on the inner planes. Well, and thus for a friend. So if the Pleiades manage to disappear, because they're fast burning compared with many of the stellar units in their sphere, the lives will still be there, I would say. Well, I think I think it is best to say that this is the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 157B, page, what's the page, 668, perhaps. If I look at this just for fun, 668, yeah, it's page 668. And beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 157C, page 668.